看完红蓝，就往那望。
Get it over with. Anyway, so I was pretty good at organic chemistry, and there's a fellow called Russell Gertner. And now the head of the department at Oregon at that time was an old German, a Prussian, called Adolf Kunz, K-U-N-Z. And he was a real Prussian type, you know, he was a militaristic, you know, with a little moustache and stood up straight. And, you know, he ran that place like the Prussian army. Now, Russell Gertner was much older than I was. He was about 26 to my 24. And he was popularly known as a man boy from Illinois. And he was an assistant lecturer and so on. But anyway, he had this young graduate student called Doris Dowie. And she was a very nice girl, but she was his student and so on. Well, couldn't suspect there'd been some shenanigans going on between Russell Gertner and Doris, but there hadn't been, but anyway. But Kunz basically said, okay, I'm not going to renew your tenure. So poor Russell Gertner, he was all set to take me on the next year once I got my master's. Well, he was kicked out. Dean left, my professor left. Well, there was another fellow called George Gordon coming in. Now, do you know George Gordon at all?
Yes, I do, actually. I saw that on your list of publications, and I said, I know George Gordon.
Do you know him personally?
He was active in history division for a while. He was at Oklahoma?
Yeah.
I think.
But he was a real character, I tell you. I don't know how well do you know him?
I haven't seen him in years.
But have you actually talked to him?
We've interacted only at the HIST meetings, that's all.
Well, he was a young guy. I understand he'd been a postdoc at Princeton. He died last year. In 2004, aged 78, and I don't wish to speak disrespectfully of the dead, please understand that, but he was a holy terror, that guy. He couldn't lecture for anything. He was a hopeless lecturer, had this high-pitched voice, low-pitched forehead. He looked almost like a monkey, you know, but he couldn't help his looks. And he had this high-pitched voice, that's my pleasure. I was murdered trying to listen to it, and he just didn't know his subject. He was just hopeless. And just as he didn't know his subject as a lecturer, he could not direct anybody. I used to say that guy couldn't direct me out of a paper bag. And he was just hopeless. Anyway, I was assigned to George Gordon. And he assured me when he finally showed up there, I think it was early September, he said, well, I've got one grant I think I'm going to get in organic chemistry, and one in inorganic chemistry. So, oh, please get the organic chemistry one and be organic synthesis. So anyway, he finally found out he wasn't going to get the organic one, he was going to get the inorganic one. Now, I should also add, there's one subject in chemistry that I'd studiously avoided, not that I didn't know anything about, but I, you know, certain things kind of grab you and certain things do not grab you. Coordination compounds didn't grab me. They left me pretty cold. Platinum complexes, rhodium complex, and all that. That's a field all unto itself. I remember Adam over in Southampton when we had some big wig, I don't remember his name, giving a talk on coordination compounds. We sat there being thoroughly bored, and Adam got up and he said, well, this is all very interesting. He thinks, but in my day, coordination compounds were usually relegated a footnote, and a very small footnote at that. That's a left-handed thank you to his high cooling voice. So I thought, well, that's not very important, so forget about it. You know, I knew what they were, and so on. But anyway, so what did I get? I got a fellowship on coordination compounds. It was studying the oxidation of cysteine, you know, the amino acid cysteine, the metal catalyzed oxidation of cysteine by iron and copper. That was the formal thing I was supposed to be working on. Well, suffice it to say, I started on the copper, got absolutely nowhere. I saw a little, it was an all aqueous solution, by the way. I was itching to work in organic solvents and things like that, you know, like organic chemists do. All I could do is work and distill water. I felt like knee-high to a grasshopper, you know. Everybody else was doing good chemistry, and I was filling with this stuff. So then after almost a year, and 6 months at least, or 7 months, I'd worked on a copper compound, couldn't get anywhere. It was totally unstable. It turned out to be lights unstable, oxygen unstable, and we didn't have the equipment not to work in an inert atmosphere. Oregon at that time was still on the primitive side. But anyway, so I got nowhere. So I had a big, thick notebook of nothing but negative results. So I said, look, let's try the iron. So he said, no, he said, you're supposed to do the contract call for us. Copper. So anyway, we wrote up this thing and went back to the the name of the agency that was giving it to us. I think the U.S. Public Health, but anyway.
Yes, you had a U.S. Public Health Service.
Is that what it was?
Fellowship.
Yeah, but anyway, I wasn't the Research Corporation. I don't remember anymore, but you're talking about, 50 years ago more? 51 years ago? Anyway, so I said, please let me work on the iron. So I started working on the iron. Well, it turned out, I didn't know it at the time, the iron catalyzes the oxidation of the SH group to the disulfide group. Boy, a bit of iron in there, and zoom, it was gone. So I add my iron solution to this sodium system, and you just see a little flash. How am I going to measure that? And we had a Beckman DU. You remember they were just coming in the boat? It was not the type you plug into the wall with a constant source of electricity. It would run on batteries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course the students would always forget to turn the thing off, so he waits about 2 hours while the thing is being charged on. It was murder trying to work with that stupid thing. And anyway, so I tried very hard to work on that. And at the end of the first year, I literally had nothing to show. I thought, how on earth am I ever going to get a PhD with all these negative results? I can tell you all kinds of ways it won't work, but not one way it will work. So by which time, Gordon was getting pretty ticked off of me, as if it was all my fault. And he decided to work on the nickel system, you know, iron, cobalt, nickel. Even he had admitted that copper was hopeless, couldn't get anywhere with it. He did do a few perfunctory experiments in his little land and didn't get anywhere with it. So anyway, he went to an ACS meeting somewhere, I don't remember where it was. I think it was in sometime in 1953, and decided to tack on a couple of weeks vacation, must be back east somewhere. And so I thought, good, well, either I'm just going to just waste a year and say I've just got to go with somebody else if I can find somebody, or apply to some of the university or do something. So I thought to myself, well, look, iron, cobalt, nickel. Nickel seems reasonably stable. Iron is hopeless. Why try cobalt? So what I did, I took a rack of test tubes, and my standard solution that I used to use, I don't remember, was about 10th or 100th normal, whatever it turned out to be. You have to look at my thesis to find out, but I can't remember. And the whole thing, and I tried these various concentrations of, I think it was ferrous sulfate, and I was getting these, cobalt sulfate. And by golly, I got a nice color. And it would stay for a little while and gradually fade away. Depending on the pH, I'd get a brown color, or a red color, or a green color. And I thought, my gosh, you know, I'm onto something here. And it was very pH sensitive, you know, you only about 2 or 3 units and it would change everything. And if you get too far, you start doing a magnificent precipitate of cystine. We learned to call it cystane and cystine, just so we knew what we were talking about. And anyway, I gleefully wrote up my sort of what I call my quick and dirty rough and ready experiments for it. We're not trying to be quantitative, you know, just to see if there was any chance at all. So I told him this, you know, and I was delighted to tell him, and when he returned to his office, instead of being delighted, he exploded. He just blew up at me. He went down to Coots and, I want to fire this man, he's not following instructions, he's no good, he's hopeless. Anyway, Coots called me down, he said, look, he told me, he said, I told Gordon, you're a Fulbright scholar, you came over here to do organic chemistry, not physical chemistry. and you were deep in inorganic chemistry, which I know you don't particularly like, but he said, I'll talk to Gorin. So he talked to Gorin, got him, but Gorin was running around the department. He had been at just about everybody, even good old Van Rysselberg, the thermodynamics professor, perfect gentleman from Belgium, even Hal Richter, nice guy, about a year older than me, good inorganic chemist, he's from Cornell. He got everybody ticked off at him. He was throwing his weight about, and he was just a holy terror there. Everybody could hate that guy's guts to be blunt about it, including me. So I thought, this is horrible. So, anyways, Kuntz said, he said, you're all right, boy. Every time he blows up, come to me and tell me what's happening. I'll get him calmed down again. But, so I went through another year of pure hell under Gorin. Everything, he tried to lay traps for me, he tried to do everything he possibly can to thwart me. By the way, he told me he was a great admirer of Mussolini. He was, and his parents had come from Como. He was born and raised in Como, really. A pretty good family, I understand. And he was a great admirer of the fascists and so on. And by the way, he hated English people. Oh, gee, I've got all the editing on for me.
So
I managed to plow through this whole thing in another year, and I think I got 6 papers in JACF out of it.
I don't have them here.
Oh, you do? You've got a list of my publications?
I put together a list.
Good grief.
Before I came out.
Well, you've been busy.
And you had a paper with Clark.
Oh, yeah, R.E.D. Clark. Yeah.
Right, also.
Oh, yeah, toluene 3,4-diethyl.
Right.
Yeah, that's it. I believe we had 2 papers.
You had 2 to get back-to-back. He had, his name was on one and your name was on the other.
Which one? Oh, you're talking about Clark and Neville?
Clark, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I did that just being nice to him, you know. I mean, basically, I did most of the work, but I was, you know, trying to pay him back. He was such a dear man. He was a good Christian, he was one of these people almost too simple for this world. I mean, he was a brilliant chemist, a brilliant physicist, and he still thought that not all Germans were bad, you know, during the war. And of course, he thought that, you know, my father used to say how important the trenches in the First World War, said, son, the only good Germans are dead ones. Well, I mean, you know how people are. And probably the German people said, the only good Englishmen are the dead ones. Well, you know, I mean, it's so silly, you can't generalize. But Clark was a wonderful, wonderful guy. I can probably give you a reasonably complete list of my publications.
Well, I would appreciate that. This is what I was able to put together, and I make no claims it's complete, but
no,
at least
no,
it gave me some sense of what you were doing, what you've been doing.
Yeah. But anyway, so I finally got this. I got my PhD, and I remember everybody showed up there, and Gorin was sort of, I think he was basically outvoted. He didn't really want to give me a PhD because he just didn't like me. And we were trying very, very hard. We even went out on picnics with him and his wife, because he got married just a little after Gene and I got married. But anyway, nothing was sort of melting at all. He had a business, but he wasn't. And I think he realized that he was having problems with the rest of the department. So I'm not saying it wasn't all my fault, I'm quite sure. But I was just, you know, facing the crowd to him. He had other students. But I remember Bob Pilmer, he couldn't stand Gorin either. He was writing all his students. He was a holy terror. I mean, he really thought he was God's gift to chemistry. And the reality was that he was anything but God's gift to chemistry. He was hopeless. So after his first, I think he stayed at Oregon maybe 3 years, 3.5. And that's when we knew he was gone, and he went down to, what was it, wasn't it University of Oklahoma Tech or something like that?
Yeah, somewhere in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
That's where I think he was when I met him.
Yeah.
England, I think, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know anymore.
I don't remember.
Let me just tell you how all this came about. I, of course, was not yet a citizen. I got out in 1954, and the only job I could find in senior news was this little job at American Marietta Company, long out of business, up there in Seattle, Washington, on Harbor Island. So I went up there, drove on a train, and I was a little bit scared of flying, because in those days it wasn't quite as easy. And so I remember getting on the train and leaving Eugene and going up there and meeting her and getting the job and so on. And I got the job there, and it was, we went out to a nice restaurant, and they knew I wasn't a citizen, and we all agreed that I was going to get $525 a month. Went out with the director of research, Lou Miller, and Bob Williams was the manager, and so on and so forth. So I remember, I'm a very good number, so $525, I came back and told her, gee, now I was going to get $525 a month. And only Bridgeport, that wasn't bad. It wasn't good, but it wasn't bad. So anyway, I go up there finally, and first paycheck works out to be $500 a month. Oh, something wrong here. I don't go on to the next paycheck, still $500 a month. So after about three or four more paychecks, I was getting to the point where I thought, well, this is not right. So I went in there and I talked to Lou Miller. I said, do you remember when we went to that beautiful restaurant? And had a filet mignon steak and so on, and even Bob Williams said I was going to get $525 a month. And one looked at the other and said, I don't remember that, do you, Bob? No, I don't remember that. I thought, well, you cheap characters, I mean, you know, $525 a month. So anyway, they agreed reluctantly to give me the $525, taking advantage of the fact I wasn't a citizen. Well, shortly after that, another Englishman who'd gone by a research corporation in Canada, I think it was called Research Corporation, I think. National Research Corporation. He'd been up there for about a year. He was from London, he came down, and they hired him too. He wasn't a citizen. And we were sitting opposite, you know, face to face, the same room. And his name was Peter Gordon Howe. And after I got to know Pete Howe, he said, how much you make? I said, well, how much you make? He said, well, I'm making $600 a month. I don't care who knows it. So I thought, well, look, you're about 3 years younger than me. I'm making $525. You've got the same qualifications as me. This isn't right. So I went in there and bid the line again, got a slight raise again. But I never got up to $600 a month. So during that course, and we're working around this business of Gordon and Neville, and he said, have you published any papers? I said, no, not yet. Well, I had, actually. Dean and...
Yes, Dean, you had one from Dean.
Dean Hayes and Neville, that's right.
Right.
And the Journal of College Science, that's right.
Right.
But that was my only publication at the time. And I said, I kept writing to Gordon saying, when are we going to publish my PhD work? Oh, I'm having it all checked out by... I've forgotten the guy's name, but anyway, some jerk that was working there. Didn't really respect this guy. He was hopeless. And he's not quite agreeing with you, and you must say, he's got to be right, you've got to be wrong, and all that. Anyway, so I kept writing for about nearly 2 years. Now, so Pete said to me, he said, look, he said, it's your work, you publish it. And he said, you can put his name on, but he said, you go first, you put it. So I did. I put his name on the first three papers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all accepted, they were peer-reviewed and everything.
And Jax was the premier journal.
That's right. So, okay, but, you know, what did I know? I that was the place to go, so I went there. And anyway, so it came out, and the next thing I knew, I got this blistering letter from Gordon saying I was unethical, I was terrible, I let everything down in the book. He went to the editor. So I wrote to the editor and explained the whole situation, so I told you about it. And the editor was very understanding. He said, well, we know about George Gordon, you know, calm down, everything's fine. He said, I would suggest that if you want to publish any more papers on the subject, read his name off. So I thought, well, they just tell me read his name off, his name comes. So I got two more papers. I mean, and he screwed himself up, two more papers. Well, you know, the man is an idiot. His papers were very, very important to people in those days, you know, and maybe still are.
What were you doing? You said Martin Marietta.
Yes.
Well, that was an aerospace company.
No, it was not. No, it was a glue factory.
Okay. I don't know why I associate Martin Marietta with aerospace.
No, that's Martin Marietta. Now, this was American Marietta.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Totally different.
I'm sorry. Okay.
No. Anyway,
what were you doing there?
Well, I was hired to work on glues for wet strength paper. In other words, toilet tissue. You read up among the high legends. Really fascinating, high-grade, challenging stuff. And my, I'm being a little bit sarcastic here, but I mean, you didn't get a PhD for that stupid work, but anyway, all you were doing was weighing the changes between urea and formaldehyde ratios, trying to cut down the odor of formaldehyde and so on, and trying to get as thin a solution as you could get by with in order to make this toilet tissue so that when it fell in water, it wouldn't come apart. I mean, you had to come apart at a certain point. You don't want it to come apart too soon, but, you know, sooner or later it comes apart. So that's what I worked on. Well, combine that boring work plus this who I was working for, and what was his name? Help me out on that name, Jenny. I'm terrible on names. Fred Horowitz. Oh, Peter okay. Horowitz. And I don't know whether you've ever seen this ad about what's it called? Something.com. You tell me, Jenny. What do you call that thing? Get your loan from somebody.com. There's this little Jewish guy sitting there and...
Oh, that one.
What do you call that?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's playing on all the stations.
Yeah.
But I don't tend to know. But I remember he looked just like Fred Horowitz.
Yeah.
And I remember when I went for my original interview, there was Fred Horowitz, there was Lou Miller, Bob Williams, and myself. And I thought, and I met about 25 other people at the company, and I came to myself, I hope to goodness I don't get stuck with that guy. With my luck, of course, I get stuck with Fred Horowitz. And he was standing there with his white coat on, his hands in his pocket, watching me do chemistry. He was the group leader, and I was his sort of lab assistant. I thought, and he was a bachelor's degree, and I was a PhD, and I thought, there's something inverted about this whole thing. I mean, you know, he should be working for me, the other. But he had this thick accent, and I don't know, the guy was a nutcase. But anyway, and he would come up with these idiotic suggestions, I mean, you know, chemically absurd suggestions. I'd have to pause them, and I was getting more and more ticked off about the whole thing. I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. I don't belong in a place like this. So I started looking around in the phone book, and there turned out to be another place which worked with plywood glues, phenol formaldehyde, and things like that, right downtown Seattle, Monsanto. So I thought, well, at least they're a chemical company as opposed to a glue factory. And so I went down there and I went from 525 or 535, where it was, to 675. Huge percentage increase. And great. So I went down and stayed there for about 2 years. And then they decided I was pretty much too high powered for them. You know, because they were a bunch of bachelor degrees, and, you know, they were perfectly happy just sticking plywood together and breaking up and saying, well, this is a 60% pay. It was all eyeball type stuff. This was not science. I was working on epoxy resins and things like that. That's how I got into epoxy resins. EPOM 828, you know, all that stuff. And so they happened to have a stockroom full of them, beautiful chemicals. They're all old chemicals, but they're perfectly good. One of them, unopened bottles, they were just perfectly good, stable stuff. So I started doing some, I'd say, overtime, a couple of hours, doing my own experiments. And I got some of my own papers published out of that. They were just little notes in JOC. But I did it. I even got a patent awarded out of it. My first patent. It was trishydroxymethylaminomethane with a reaction with certain isocyanates. And I think isocyanates too.
Yeah, okay.
It was just a little squibble thing. But I just wanted to, you know, keep my foot in the organic department, so to speak, instead of all this nonsense going on, all these dunks and glues. Because I'm one of these people that, in fact, I got so fed up with dunks and glues, I used to say, I'm not a polymer chemist, I'm a monomer chemist. You know. Well, anyway, so during the course of that 3-year period between 1954 and 1957, I took a course in Seattle to become a citizen. Because I found out, it's another thing that gets you. Nowadays, they walk across the border and they're here, they can't speak English, you know, they creep under the wire and do anything. And they blend the population fine. In my day, I had to go to school, I had to know the answers to 500 questions about American history. And I'd bone out, I knew every darn question. I did my homework. And so, in 1957, by the way, the course was taught by a French woman. who had a sort of a distinct French accent, but she knew her stuff too. And I think it was in July of, or June, I guess it was June of 57, wasn't it? Late June of 57. I went down there to the American Embassy or wherever it is there, and I had to have a sponsor. It was one of your friends, you remember, sponsoring me.
Yeah.
Because the wife couldn't sponsor, you know, even though I was married to an American citizen. And she signed the sponsor and so on, and I signed up. And remember, he asked me a question, you know, and I asked, boom, just like that, so-and-so, another answer, so-and-so. And he said, you're through. I said, well, wait a minute. I said, there's another, what was it, 497 questions to go here. He said, well, all right. So he asked me two or three more. He said, get out of here. He said, you didn't know it. He said, so anyway, I said, you mean I'm through? He said, yeah, you're through.